Welcome to Question Period. I'm Evan Solomon. Denials, ducking questions, and damage control.
To divest all of my and my family's assets in Warner-Chappell.
Can the embattled finance minister save his credibility by selling off his multi-million-dollar stock portfolio? Has the government's biggest asset suddenly become their biggest liability? Bill Morneau declined to come on the program today, but we'll dig into this with his parliamentary secretary and then on the scrub. Plus, NAFTA nightmare.
We have seen proposals that would turn back the clock on 23 years of predictability, openness, and collaboration under NAFTA.
Is the U.S. trying to sabotage NAFTA with outrageous demands? Canada's former ambassador to the U.S., Gary Doer, and the former conservative leader and NAFTA advisor, Rana Ambrose, join us today. Then, burqa ban.
Seeing your face, you seeing mine, is part of a normal and healthy communication.
Quebec passes a new law that would ban anyone who covers their face from riding the bus. Is it racist or reasonable? The former Bloc Québécois leader, Gilles Duceppe, is here. All that, plus the scrum weighs in. This is Question Period. Let's go get some answers.
Today, the finance minister admitted that his ethical standards are in tatters. Ministers are not supposed to directly own shares in companies, especially those they regulate.
Let's start with the very first fact that I disclosed all of my assets to the Ethics Commission.
After weeks of being battered by the opposition over his small business tax plans, over allegations of conflict of interest about his multi-million dollar stock portfolio, the finance minister, Bill Morneau, made an about-face, trying to cover his assets, as it were.
Moved forward and put my assets in a blind trust.
His own party actually thought he'd done that 2 years ago. Now, he's also selling off stock in the company he used to work with, Morneau-Chappell. That stock will net him about $21 million. A defiant Morneau maintains he's done nothing wrong.
I, perhaps naively, thought that, you know, in Canada, following the rules and respecting the recommendations of the Ethics Commissioner, respecting the recommendations of an officer of parliament, would be what Canadians would expect, would meet up to their high expectations.
Maybe he was naive, but the opposition is not buying it.
This minister always does the right thing after he's caught doing exactly the opposite.
So what happens when you add one-third and two-thirds other than a finance minister in a whole mess of trouble?
It absolutely is, and a shame on the Prime Minister for not having the decency of ensuring that his finance minister is following the law.
Does the finance minister have the credibility to stay on the job? We have repeatedly asked the finance minister to join us today. He was not available to come on, but we begin today with his parliamentary secretary, Joëlle Lightbaum. Thanks so much for coming on. Obviously, I got to ask you the questions that I would have asked the finance minister if he was made available. Did the finance minister mislead both the public and your own party when he did not correct the perception, widely shared, that he'd had his family fortune in a blind trust?
Now, I think what's important to remember is when we get elected as member of parliament, when we enter office either as parliamentary secretary, as minister, as parliamentarians, the first obligation you have is really to work with the ethics commissioner, to meet with the ethics commissioner, disclose your assets, and follow the path that she sets for you as a member of parliament, as an elected official. Now, the ethics commissioner, immediately after the election, met with Bill Morneau, and she provided the path forward for him, which meant for Minister Morneau to have a wall, a conflict of interest wall, which would prevent conflicts or appearance of conflicts of interest. She's also said that there was no need to set up a blind trust.
So you're saying he followed the letter of the law, is that what you're saying?
It's followed not only the letter of the law, but the recommendations of the ethics commissioner setting up that conflict of interest wall, which in a letter released this week, the ethics commissioner mentioned this is to preserve the integrity and the confidence that the public place in parliamentarians. This is what you need to do, okay. And this is what has been done.
Here's the problem, I should just say. One, your own members in your own party were saying, why are you questioning Bill Morneau? He has it in a blind trust. He never bothered to correct that until the media found that out. That's the first thing. That's a problem. Second of all, it wasn't the letter of the law that he was just supposed to follow. When he became finance minister, all ministers were given a mandate letter from the prime minister. And I'll read it to you. And he says, quote, simply acting within the law is not enough. That's the prime minister to your finance minister. And he said, follow the ethics guidelines. You can't even reasonably seen to be in conflict. How does that follow your own Prime Minister's rule?
It's not just following the letter of the law. It's following the recommendation that the Ethics Commissioner has put forward to set up that conflict of interest wall. But now the Minister, and I think it's important to point out this week, to avoid the distraction, to avoid the noise, and he's a man of great integrity that's dedicated the last two years of his life to public service and done so with remarkable results for the Canadian economy, for the Canadian middle class. And I think the number speaks for themselves. Fastest growth in the G7. Back 2 years ago, if you recall, we were debating whether Canada was heading into a recession or in a recession. But this week, to avoid that distraction, Minister Morneau came out, called the Ethics Commissioner, and went above and beyond what the path that she had set forward for him. So he's selling all of his assets, putting all of his assets in a blind trust, disposing of all his shares in Morneau Chapelles and the shares of his family. And I think that's a step even above and beyond what's expected of parliamentarians.
He's a light bulb, but he's waited 2 years to do it. You've called this noise, so has the finance minister, and a distraction. For a lot of people, this is actually a little more important than that. Can you tell me, why did the finance minister use a corporate structure to own that villa in France? Why does he use numbered companies and other corporate structures? The charge is that he's using those to avail himself of lower tax, the same quote-unquote loopholes, to use the liberal word, that he's trying to close for some Canadians, but avail himself of for himself.
The person and the institution that is designed to safeguard the integrity of Parliament and to make sure that there are no conflicts of interest is the Ethics Commissioner. Right. And the Minister has always worked with the Ethics Commissioner, followed her directives, and made sure that he was at all times in compliance.
Did he know that in 2013 she said these rules that I have to follow are no good, that these rules are weak, we should toughen them up? The Prime Minister put his stuff in a blind trust. Why not the Finance Minister?
To that effect, I think we should always, I think the Ethics Commissioner, as it were, has all the tools at her disposal to make sure that the integrity of Parliament and of parliamentarians is respected, but we should always listen to the Ethics Commissioner. I think she's a very well-respected, Mary Dawson is well-respected.
Canadians want to know, a lot of this, there's substance and there's optics. A lot of this could be about hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. Have you, as his parliamentary secretary, have you asked the finance minister why he used corporate structures to own his place in France?
Well, what I'm confident is that the Ethics Commissioner, the minister, has always worked in a forthcoming manner, in full transparency, with the Ethics Commissioner to make sure that all the rules that govern us as parliamentarians are respected.
But he said he forgot to report that corporation, so I'm just asking you, did you ask him, why did you use that? Because some are saying he's caught in his own loophole.
Well, what I'm confident is that the minister has at all times followed the law, followed the Ethics Commissioner's guidelines and recommendations. What I also know about the finance minister is that he's taken an economy that was weak and has steered it in the right direction towards growth and prosperity, and has done it while reducing child poverty by 40%. I think it talks about the record of this finance minister, who's a man who's left the private sector to serve the public with great integrity, and I have the utmost trust in the finance minister.
The opposition reads what the ethics guidelines that your prime minister wrote and said, and argues that your government has now lowered your own ethical standards in order to save the credibility of the finance minister.
Well, the opposition will say what they have to say to sometimes distract the attention. Now they are going after the finance minister, who's respected the law at all times, who's respected the Ethics Commissioner's recommendations, and who's done remarkably well for the Canadian economy in the last
years. So if everything was perfect, why does he make all these changes? I'm just trying, why didn't he just say why? I've done everything right. Why now the blind trust? Why now sell off the shares? Why couldn't he have done that 2 years ago and this problem never would have existed?
Well, I think the finance minister, when he entered office, as all parliamentarians thought, rightfully so in my mind, to that meeting with the Ethics Commissioner, disclosing in a forthcoming manner all of his assets and making sure that he follows the guidelines and the path that she sets for him, was sufficient. Now he's going further than what's required, what's expected.
Okay, last question. Will your government now drop this bill that talks about pension reform because of the previous relationship? I still hasn't sold off his assets in Morneau Chapelle, but will your government now drop that, or can the finance minister have anything to do with any of that pension business?
Well, right now, Bill C-27, what you're referring to, is before Parliament. It's passed only first reading, so I don't know where it's heading at this point. What I mean to say is it's open before Parliament. We'll see where it leads, but there's no indication.
All right, Mr. Lightbound, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So that is the government's position. If you want to see the opposition debate this and their response, you can check out our MPs online at ctvnews.ca. The NDP and the Conservatives weigh in. Later in the program, the Scrum will dig into this. But coming up next, is the U.S. now trying to sabotage NAFTA behind closed doors? Are they ready to build a trade wall on the Canadian border? Former Conservative leader Rona Ambrose and former ambassador to the U.S. Gary Doer are next. Stay with us on Question Period.
We've also seen a series of unconventional proposals in critical areas of the negotiations that make our work much more challenging. This is troubling.
Well, it's getting nasty in the back rooms as fears grow that the U.S. is actually trying to sabotage the NAFTA negotiations by making excessive demands for big concessions from both Canada and Mexico. Now, may not be a surprise dealing with Donald Trump. That's like trying to brush your teeth with a chainsaw. You got to be very, very careful. But what's really going on behind closed doors? Is this deal going sideways? To find out, I'm joined by the former Canadian ambassador to the United States, Gary Doer, and the former Conservative leader and now NAFTA advisory panel member, Rona Ambrose. Great to have both of you on the program today. And Rona Ambrose, I got to start with you. Are the U.S. demands now unreasonable to the point where Canada's got to start thinking, when do we walk away?
Look, I don't think Canada should walk away. I think that we have to stay at the table. But yes, the Americans' demands are completely unreasonable. They may not seem unreasonable for the Americans, but they are definitely unreasonable for the Mexicans and the Canadians. And they put NAFTA at risk. They put the actual agreement at risk. And, you know, I actually think just a week ago, Evan, I would have said to you, you know, this is sort of typical negotiating in a trade agreement. I'm hearing that from trade negotiators about a week or two ago. But now, after this last round of talks, that is not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that people are extremely worried about where this is going. And people use language behind the scenes like, it looks like the Americans are driving towards a cliff on this and Canada will have to follow. And we don't want to see that. So I actually think it's time for us to be worried. I think we are worried behind the scenes. And I think we have to start activating everyone who understands why it matters that this agreement cannot fall apart. And that means on both sides of the border.
All right. We should be worried, says Rona Ambrose. She's one of the advisors. Gary Doer, I mean, I get all negotiations get tense, but signals that I hear as well is that this is, in the back rooms, this is more than just typical. The rhetoric and the demands are non-starters. Where are you on that?
Well, I think the rhetoric is a non-starter, and obviously the positions the United States has put on the table are non-starters for Canada, and we will state that unequivocally with the Americans. This is very serious, but we have to figure out a win for all sides, including Canada, and a win that's not detrimental to the Canadian public and Canadian business.
All right. Let me get to the raw politics, because Gary Doer is saying that we need to find a win, Rona Ambrose. Let's just look at it from Donald Trump's point of view. In my view,
right,
and maybe I'm wrong, but it's a win for him if he gets a deal that benefits America and it's by American, and that's what his demands are all about. But it's also a win if he dumps the deal, because that's what he's promised to do all along. So he has two ways to win. We have one way to win, which is getting a good deal for Canada, which he doesn't want. So where does that leave Canada?
Well, it doesn't leave us in a good place. And that's why I think, you know, I think a lot of people thought that maybe the rhetoric coming right from the election with Donald Trump's talking about tearing up NAFTA and it's the worst deal ever. And some of the stuff that we thought would be put on the table, it all, I think, came to bear in this last round where they actually put this stuff on the table. They're serious about it. The rhetoric is not changing. And the truth is, if you read what he says and you listen to what Lighthizer is saying, it is very troubling. And while we can talk all day long about that Canada's not the target, it's actually Mexico, it's a trilateral agreement. And if they pull out, it affects us. And I got to tell you, I'm really concerned about this analysis lately where people are saying, oh, it's okay, we'll be better off without NAFTA, or it's okay, we'll just fall back on WTO tariffs. All of this is very complicated and hard for the regular Canadian to understand, but that's not a good idea. NAFTA is very important for the Canadian economy. We are a small economy. We are very trade exposed. We're highly integrated with the American economy when it comes to supply chains, especially in manufacturing. And pulling out of NAFTA will create uncertainty in our economy. No, the world won't end overnight, but it will create uncertainty, and we don't need that. And
okay,
that will affect jobs. It'll affect investment. And you know what? Canada is much more exposed than the United States. So I agree with you. The way things are headed, Trump wins either way, but Canada does not. And I'm really concerned about it.
Is it time, given that, Gary Doer, we want the deal, we got to stay at the table, I understand that, but do we have to now prepare for a plan B? And if so, what is that? What does life look like in Canada without NAFTA?
Well, you always have to be prepared for positive results and more negative results. Having said that, I do believe that when we're dealing with a person who perceives himself to be a populist in the United States, we have to... We've done a really good job of outreach with the Prime Minister and the Premiers and business and labor with the various parties. I think we've got to deal with some of these populist arguments from the United States with populist arguments back. We should talk in populist language. We should continue to make the case we're your ally. You know, we're there with you defeating ISIS. So we've got to talk over the White House and over the negotiating table and remind people of the populist reasons to have a good trading relationship with Canada.
Okay, logic may matter, facts may matter. Donald Trump, I'm not sure what his loyalty is to all that, and we know he's a protectionist, but Ron Ambrose, just candidly, do you think, now we're in round four, you've watched this as closely as anybody, do you think that the U.S. is actively trying to sabotage this thing, that there are poison pills in there, they're waiting for this thing to blow up? That hands Donald Trump some kind of political victory. He's vindicated. It was a lousy deal. I blew it up.
I think they've set the stage for that. I think they absolutely have set the stage for that. Now, I have a shred of optimism left in that we have a little extra time. They've decided to put a month between the last round of negotiations and the next one. And I agree with Gary wholeheartedly that now is the time to activate and engage anybody that you know on the other side of the border that cares about the North American economy, but the Canadian and U.S. trading relationship. This is about more about the Canadian economy for us than it is about the American economy, frankly. They are a much larger economy. They can withstand more economic shock than we can when it comes to trade. But I am worried. I think they've set the stage for Donald Trump to do either pull out or stay in. And I know that NAFTA will not unravel overnight. Business to business relationships will not end overnight if Trump sends that tweet out and says, you know, we're pulling out of NAFTA. But it will create uncertainty. There will be currency impacts on the Canadian currency. There will be impacts in the markets. And there will be a level of uncertainty around investment in Canada. So, you know, Trump has set himself up to win no matter what. And it's all about America first. And that's his ultimate populist argument.
Gary.
And for us, I think I'm concerned.
Gary, last word to you. The new U.S. ambassador to Canada, Kelly Knightcraft, will present her letters of credence in Ottawa on Monday. I guess the question is, you're a former ambassador. Can she in any way help to move these negotiations forward? Some think she's more moderate than Donald Trump on this. Can she help Canada get a good deal?
Well, she definitely can help, and I'm glad she's going to be in Ottawa, I think, on Monday. I think that's wonderful. But I would say that for the new ambassador and for the president and for the administration, the criteria for being reelected in the United States is peace and prosperity. And you'll note that Donald Trump is engaging now on a tax reform package, again, because of what he believes is important for the economy. As Wilbur Ross has said, in these trade negotiations, one of the criteria is do no harm. And if you rip apart NAFTA, there's going to be economic chaos and economic consequences. And I would suggest that is also a very strong argument for Canada to have stability. Donald Trump can't get reelected as president if he doesn't have prosperity in the United States. And part of that prosperity depends on trade with North America and trade with the world. And having this uncertainty will hurt U.S. companies around the world. So this is not necessarily, it's not necessarily a win to get a one-day headline and have unemployment in your own country. It certainly will create more difficulty in Canada, but it won't be without consequences in the United States as well.
All right. Well, see if we can get the Twitter machine out of the president's hand, and we'll find out what happens with these negotiations. Gary Doer and Ronna Ambrose, great to have both of you on the program. Really appreciate your insights today. Thanks so much. Quebec just passed a new law that bans religious face coverings when receiving public services, even riding the bus. Some think it's racist, others think the law should go further. Former federal Bloc Quebec Oil leader Gilles Duceppe weighs in on this topic next. Stay with Question Period.
It has nothing to do with the public space and how people should dress in the morning. I don't care about how people dress in the morning. But when you are in the area of public services, this is where society has to send a signal.
Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard defending his government's controversial new law, widely known as the burqa ban, which prevents people with face coverings like the niqab or the burqa from being worn when giving or receiving public services in that province. That would include riding public buses. This is an issue the Prime Minister has opposed, but very carefully.
I will always stand up for Canadians' rights. I will always stand up for the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It's what Canadians expect of me. As a federal government, we're going to take our responsibilities seriously and look carefully at what the implications
are. So that means going before the courts?
It means looking carefully at the implications of this law and how we continue to stand up for Canadians' rights.
Now, protests have already erupted against this. They're calling it racist. You've got women wearing bandanas over their face at bus stops to show the government is going too far on this. But opposition parties in Quebec, like the PQ, voted against the bill because they believe it doesn't go far enough. Is this a problem in search of a solution or not? To find out more on this, I'm joined now by the former Bloc Québécois leader, Gilles Duceppe. Good to have you on the program, Monsieur Duceppe. Do you think this bill is racist or is it reasonable?
No, I think it's not well done. I think we should go back to the Bouchard-Taylor report 10 years ago. And that report said, and we participated, the Bloc, at that commission, and it said very clearly that people representing the state with and the authority with power of coercion shouldn't have any religious sign. That means judges, policemen, soldiers, and so on. Having said that, to be covered, to have the face cover or not, I think we have to use common sense and find accommodation. I don't see any problem with a woman coming in a bus with a covered face, but if we ask to identify her because she got a bus card, like we have to identify ourselves because our picture is on it, just like the passport, just like when you're taking the plane, if you're asked to identify yourself, then she would ask to identify herself also. Rendering the service with uncovered face, I think it's common sense also. Not having a covered face in a bank, a hood, a tinted visor, a jab, or so on, I think it's common sense also.
But hold on.
You can't ban that in the streets.
You say it's common sense. Let's talk about, does the state, does the government have the right to tell people what to wear? Does a bus driver have the right to say to someone who may religiously want to cover their face, or for other reasons, you can't get on my bus until you uncover your face? Does the state have a right to legislate wardrobe?
Well, what I'm saying is that if that person has a bus card with their picture on it, just like the passport, and you ask to identify yourself, then you have to uncover your face. But then you can cover it and be in the bus. I think this is common sense. Just like I think having a helmet when you're driving a motorcycle, it's a question of safety and security. A hard hat in the construction sector or in the Montreal Harbor. So this is common sense. So a woman could have her face covered in a bus, but if asked to identify herself, then she has to identify herself.
Gilles Duceppe, can you explain to many people outside of Quebec who are having trouble understanding why there was a need for this at all? What is the big problem? Where has safety been compromised in Quebec, a province, I should add, where six Canadian Muslims were gunned down in a mosque? Where has the problem been in Quebec from a safety or communications point with people covering their face? I'm just trying to figure out what this is trying to solve.
Well, I think to give services, it's normal to have people with a non-covered face. You have some things in the criminal code in Canada concerning polygamy. It's permitted by the Muslim religion, but not by the state. So the state is the state, the religion is the religion.
Okay, but again, those people outside of Quebec may wonder, Quebec politicians, and you used to be one, would say, you know, there's a secular state and religion is different. And yet in the National Assembly, there is a cross, a crucifix that hangs over there. Clearly there's a lot of religious heritage that the state says—
It shouldn't be there.
Okay, so you think that's hypocrisy. Can you explain to me why the, you know, Ontario doesn't want a law like this, most other provinces don't want it, and but yet the party like the PQ, they believe it doesn't go far enough. Is this fair to— Is it fair to say that this is really just about religious Muslims, that that's what this is really about?
No, I think when you're comparing the situation of people coming to Canada, Quebec or Ontario, I don't think there's such a big difference. I know what is the situation in Ontario, what is the situation in Quebec, and I went all around in Canada. So, but I think that it happens a lot of time in the rest of Canada, and when Quebec's taking the decisions, instead of trying to understand the decisions, we start Quebec bashing.
What's Quebec bashing? We're just trying to sort this out. I'm not sure.
Just take the Kirpan. It is banned in the plains. Why is it permitted in the schools? It's banned in the plain. Everywhere in Canada, everywhere in the world. So,
well, what do you say to the new NDP? What do you say to the new NDP leader? What do you say to the new NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, who actually has a kirpan, which is the ceremonial knife that Sikhs wear?
Yes, but it's a knife also. I don't have any problem with him having a turban on his head when he was elected like that. No problem with that at all. But the kirpan is also a knife. And if he goes in a plane, he doesn't have the right to have it.
Gilles Duceppe, good to have this conversation with you. Fascinating, the politics of this new law in Quebec. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, the scrum is coming up next. Is the finance minister, Bill Morneau, no more? Under fire for his handling of his personal finances and the new tax changes for small businesses, was his mea culpa enough to save his credibility? We'll find out next on the scrum. Stay with Question Period. The finance minister hit the road last week trying to sell his controversial changes to small businesses. The prime minister gave him a hand. Well, more than a hand. He tried to shield Bill Morneau from the media onslaught. Check it out.
I do have a question for Mr. Morneau directly, if he'd be able to answer one. He is right.
Yes, but you have to ask a question of me first, because you get a chance to talk to the prime minister.
It's more like political babysitting there. Has the finance minister's credibility been so damaged that it now can't recover? Does he need to be tossed from cabinet, or does he ride this out? Has he done the damage control? Joining us today on the Scrum, CTV Ottawa Bureau Chief Joyce Napier and Stephanie Levitz from the Canadian Press, CTV's chief political commentator, of course, Craig Oliver, and the pollster, the man himself, chairman of Nanos Research, Nick Nanos. Great to have all of you here. Nick, let's just get right into the raw politics of this. Bill Morneau thinks he's put this all behind him. He's put his savings in a blind trust. He's going to sell off the family fortune. How damaged is he?
Well, you know, the thing is that there's a negative trajectory on the Liberal numbers, and I can't see that reversing. So the reality is he's just got to somehow survive this in order for hopefully some other news event to happen to distract Canadians, because this is bad news for him and for the government.
Okay, Stephanie, is Morneau no more, or can he ride it out?
Well, it's the thing you said. I mean, the Prime Minister gave him a hand, and what a lot of people are saying is Prime Minister should give him the boot is what they should give him, right? He's lost the public's trust, and this is the man in charge of the public finances. So he can talk about moving his assets into blind trusts and all that stuff, but does that matter to the average Canadian? Because what they hear is, hey, you're a guy who's making way more money than I am, and you've been hiding it while coming after me for how much tax I pay.
All right, is that it? Is that the idea, Craig, that hypocrisy is political kryptonite, even if he clings to the fact that he says, I've done nothing wrong on the substance?
I don't think it's unfair to suggest that throughout this whole thing, Morneau has been duplicitous. He told us, he told reporters, he told his own colleagues in cabinet, most of whom have blind trusts, he told his own company that he was going to put all of his vast fortune in a blind trust. We all believed that all of that time. He allowed us to believe that until the Globe blew the whistle on him. So, he's got to stand now, having, I think, lost a lot of trust. He says that he was probably naive in doing this, and I think we would have to be naive to believe that he didn't jump in to the right through that loophole because he needed to protect his vast fortune and his assets, and he wasn't going to be able to do that in the same way in a blind trust.
Joyce, is he caught in his own loophole, as it were?
Well, you know, I think it's a man who found sainthood after he got caught, really, is what it is, right? This week, you know, our own colleague, Glenn McGregor, explained these numbered companies and how he was trying to shelter his money, which is, you know, a basic human instinct. And we can't fault him for that. What I think you can fault him for is then to have gone around the country and told people who make less money than him, as Stephanie said, and told them, you can no longer take advantage of these loopholes. We're going to close these loopholes, the same ones that he took advantage of. So don't do as I do, do as I say. Is that what he's telling Canadian people? So credibility, not so much.
But there's an even bigger political risk because the Prime Minister is starting to engage. Let's rewind back to Paul Martin and the sponsorship scandal. He had nothing to do with that. He tried to do damage control, and then people connected him with the problem. Right. And, you know, his numbers were in the stratosphere, too, when he was first Prime Minister. And they dropped like a lead balloon. So I think the Prime Minister has to be very careful not to engage on this issue personally, because people will make the connection between him and the problem.
I don't think any Prime Minister can long have a finance minister who can, in his case, I think, never really be the vicar of Canadian economic policy the way some of the great finance ministers have been. And you've got to wonder if at some point in the next, maybe even over the Christmas holidays or in the next year, he decides he wants to go back to his company and retires, says he's going to resign, and then Trudeau finds himself a new finance
minister. Let me play the other card here, because I think there's a very different narrative that the Prime Minister's office is saying. We've got the fastest growing economy in the G7. That's their argument. We've lowered tax on small businesses. People in 6 months, they won't remember all this technical stuff about the blind trust. I've sold off the company. I put this behind me. And the Prime Minister, and they're going to come out, Stephanie, with a fiscal report next week that the deficit's smaller. So is that narrative, does that hold any water?
This is an ethical issue now. Ethics can and have damaged governments severely.
And also, I would argue that, like, poll and poll again, as Nick would be able to tell us, people's outlook on the economy never matches what the numbers actually tell us. So you can come out with the happiest fiscal statement in the world, everyone gets a unicorn, everyone gets a pony, and people are still going to believe they're left with nothing but some mud on their shoes. And so the numbers don't matter, it's how people are feeling. When they don't have trust in their government, they don't feel very good about that government.
Jewish. And, you know, watch those lowering those the tax rate for small businesses. It was not in the first budget, not in the second budget. It was a campaign promise. They pop it onto us now this week to change the narrative. So this mistake is already costing us, their estimates, $2.9 billion
expensive
to taxpayers.
Damage control.
Right? So the damage control so far has cost taxpayers $2.9 billion and the government probably a few seats, or, you know, Nick will be able to tell us that. But that's sort of what they've done so far to control
the Liberals have come down to earth, and now it's a race. The gap is narrowing between the Liberals and the Conservatives. The NDP have a new leader. The Conservatives have their leader in place, and the Liberals are now fighting.
Has this, Nick, had an effect, though? Do we know of this stuff? Because it's been brutally, this is a government, what's happened, right? They used to be so on message, and they used to have kind of an ear for this stuff. There's something they developed a tenure. Has it hit them directly, this stuff?
Well, it has hit them directly, because, you know, the other thing is it'd be fair to say that the Liberals have said all the right things. They said what people wanted them to say to get elected and for the first part of their mandate. But not only are they fighting with this, there are a lot more Canadians that are wondering, okay, so what have the Liberals accomplished? It's time to deliver. And, you know, it's 2 years in. Tick tock, in 2 years, there'll be an election.
The other thing that's hit them directly has been a very competent expertise, almost, on the part of the Scheer-led Conservative opposition. They were good. They've been good in the last couple of weeks on this, and they forced Morneau to change face.
Well, that's a great point, Craig and Steph. Let me just bring that to you, because while the Liberals have been floundering, this has been a gift for two new leaders, the new leader of the Conservative Party, Andrew Scheer, and Jagmeet Singh for the NDP. What has this issue done for them?
Well, what's interesting for Andrew Scheer is it's given him a way to introduce himself to Canadians, which is something he really sorely lacked. And I don't know if any of you folks have seen the TV ads they're running right now. Hi, I'm Andrew Scheer, and I'm here to fight on behalf of small business. And that's the bread and butter Conservative narrative, right? I mean, we can talk about the right-wing stuff, we can talk about the populist agenda, but it comes down at the end of the day for them a strong economic message and a strong narrative. And if you think about how successful they were, you know, with Michael Ignatieff, he didn't come back for you. Right. One line, and it destroyed Michael Ignatieff. And all they've got to do is find the tagline to slap on this one for the Liberals, and they're going to, you know, keep ascending.
Well,
right?
The question is, I mean, and you wonder, have they been distracted by NAFTA? They've been so much focused trying to keep NAFTA on, right? And you've got their entire staff, Nick, on NAFTA. And yet, all of a sudden this summer they've let their own agenda just slip away. How do they, and by the way, NAFTA's, we don't know what's going to happen there. How do they get anything? Can they get back on track here?
I'm not sure if they can get back on track, but the reality is I don't think NAFTA is going to do anything for them in the short period because it's basically stalled. So they've got their signature policy piece stalled. They've got their other signature policy piece on taxes kind of in the mud, and they're like spinning their wheels, and the opposition parties are licking their chops.
By the way, what's the government going to do about C-27? Remember, that's the bill dealing with pensions that could enrich Morneau's old company and was the cause of him having a potential, I think, an absolute, actually, conflict of interest. Are they going to press ahead with that bill? If they do, we'll be hearing about this all over again. The bill's been introduced, it's been sitting there for a year. My guess is we'll never hear from it again.
Yeah.
And the opposition has filed a complaint to the commissioner, to the ethics commissioner, about this bill, C-27, that they claim would profit Chappelle Morneau. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, this may have a second life. This whole story may have a second life if she does investigate.
Joyce, you say a complaint, but also we haven't even mentioned the word villa. I mean, how can we go on? There's also an ethics complaint to the ethics commissioner about the fact he didn't disclose the corporation that owns his villa in the south of France. So this can't go away right away, right? Because there's going to be more steps to this, right?
Absolutely. I mean, definitely. I mean, this is not finished. It's not that he didn't, and we have to specify that. He did declare the villa. What he did not declare was the corporation that he and his wife own that own the villa.
Right.
So is it a way for him to not pay the punishing French taxes, perhaps?
Okay, we got to take a short break. The Scrum will be back to talk about the debate over what's called the burqa law in Quebec. A new law in Quebec bans people from wearing veils over their faces. Is it racist or reasonable? Why are federal leaders being so quiet? We'll talk about that next. Stay with Question Period. Welcome back to Question Period. Joyce, Stephanie, Craig, and Nick Nanos are all back on the Scrum. Now, some are calling this new law in Quebec racist. Others think it actually needs to be more strict. It's called the Religious Neutrality Law. It used to be called Bill 62. It passed in Quebec's legislature this week. It's a watered-down version of the former Charter of Values that the PQ once wanted to pass. It bans face coverings from being worn when giving or receiving public service. Can't even ride the bus with it. And lots of protests about it. Is it racist or not? Why are federal leaders not speaking out more forcefully on this, Nick? I mean, outside of Quebec, where the debate has been much longer and more fierce, this has no other province is going to pass something like this. Why have federal leaders been so quiet about commenting on this political minefield?
Well, that's exactly it, because it is a political minefield. Everyone has an opinion on this. It's very polarizing. You know, for the Conservatives, they see it as a way to mobilize their core. It's going to be interesting to see how Jagmeet Singh tries to kind of manage this within his own party. And you know, for the Liberals, it's just one of those things where, you know, the Liberals, to do well in the next election, have to do well in rural Quebec, and they have to do well in Ontario, and this is a minefield in both of those political battlefields.
Joyce, where are you on this? Because this thing is, as he said, it's a minefield. Explain why it's so difficult. Trudeau, at one point in 2015, he was very open about opposing the anti-NICAB stuff.
Yeah, because, I mean, he doesn't want to go there. He doesn't want to touch it right now, although he did. He did make comments, to be fair. He did address it. He didn't turn around and shy away from the mic. But this is all part of Quebec's, like, 10-year quest for religious neutrality. You had the Bouchard-Taylor Commission. You have all sorts of studies. You have the charter. You have this. You have that. And it's sort of like wanting to play in a huge, you know, sort of mud pit and not want to get dirty. You cannot. We tried here in the House of Commons to talk about Islamophobia, and those who even raised a slight opposition or wanted to change a slight word were called Islamophobes. This is an issue that you cannot tread without getting bruised.
All right. This goes back to the last election. Thomas Mulcair believes his opposition to that Charter of Values and the NICAB situation cost him the election. What do you make of the politics of this one?
It's about articulating what's going on, right? I mean, to Joyce's point, it's a 10-year quest on behalf of the Quebec government for this secular society. But at the same time, when you have attitudes like this, you know, that say, don't wear a face veil, women to this, women to that, you have to look at where are those attitudes coming from, and can we articulate a response to those attitudes that is less about the question and more about the source of the anxiety. What's the issue with the face veil? Is it that you can't see them? Is it that you think they're stealing your job? Like, and what's the government response to that need to be that takes the politics away from it and makes it more of a policy thing that stops people being so afraid that these are a risk of some kind?
There's a very somber side to this. I think most people believe that it is targeting Muslims. Quebec is the only political jurisdiction in the continent, as far as I know, where Muslims have been murdered inside their own mosques. In addition to that, where there's been a huge fight over whether Muslims could have their own burial ground. There is a background there that is somber and kind of tragic about, and I think I understand why Trudeau's handling this delicately, particularly because he's got a friendly liberal federalist government that is trying to head off the separatists who are much stronger in this than they are.
And also, we have to say this, this law was passed this past week in the shadow of a crucifix in the National Assembly.
Oh, not just any crucifix.
Okay.
A very large crucifix.
No, we've got to establish that, right? Yeah. So there's a little bit of incoherence here, just a little bit.
But Steph, you say we got to separate the policy from the politics. I just can't see the policy here. Like, is this a solution in search of a problem, as I keep asking?
That's what I'm
saying.
Like,
this is all raw politics, isn't it?
Or thinly veiled racism, pardon my choice of words there. Like, to Craig's point, right, what is this really about? Is it about a secular society, or is it about profound discomfort with Muslims in particular, and the government going after that? And other religions, and the government going after that? And what does that say about the general state of affairs in Quebec in terms of everything, in terms of the economy, in terms of people's use of integration? And those are bigger policy problems, in my view, than, you know, if you get rid of a veil, everyone's going to suddenly feel better about themselves.
This law will not stand, of course.
No.
It is clearly a violation of the Charter for someone, because of their religion, to be denied public services, which all other citizens are entitled to, is against the Charter. They will lose. What will happen politically after that? Who knows, except it'll be once again a federalist, Supreme Court imposing on Quebec things they don't want.
But Craig, I agree with you 100%. So does the Liberal government in Quebec think that this is good politics? They must, because they're moving forward on this. Right?
I tell you, on our talk radio programs, this gets, I would say, 75% support. People from outside of Quebec, they like this. This connects. It's populist, even though pundits and a lot of politicians say it's not good. So this is interesting. Why are who is this most dangerous as a federal leader? Steph, I can start with you. Is it most dangerous for Jagmeet Singh and the NDP, for Justin Trudeau, or for Andrew Scheer? Who does this hurt?
Andrew Scheer. Because Andrew Scheer, the 2015 election, as we discussed off the top here, right, was partially, I don't want to say it was fought on this issue of the kneecap, but the tone of that election, the tone of people being tired of the Harper Conservatives, it pivoted around this kneecap issue, that we're tired of these politics of fear, division. That was Trudeau's message. But it resonated very strongly with the Conservative base. So what does Andrew Scheer do with it now? Does he embrace the same messaging that his predecessor did and keep his base all rallied up? Or does he acknowledge, as he keeps saying, we want to put forward a positive vision, we want to be, you know, the party of all Canadians? And how does he balance those two things in a party that has previously been quite in favor of this type of legislation?
Joyce, who's in most danger? They're all kind of say this is provincial's jurisdiction, so they're trying to put an arm's length on it.
I think they all are. I really do think this is a minefield. And I don't know who's going to win, and I don't know if this game has any winners at all. What is interesting is, let's bring it back down to earth. How are they going to apply this? So our bus drivers in Montreal are already saying, what are we, the burqa police? We're not. So what if somebody walks on a bus and it's cold and it's minus 30 and we're covered up to here, as we are in Canada, and what are they going to say? Balaclava, yes. A burqa, no. Like, this is not going to, it's not possible to apply this, and it's going to be chaotic.
The enforcement has got all sorts of possibilities.
But the twist is, from a polling perspective, the one party that's been trending up in Quebec over the last 5 weeks, the Bloc Québécois. They've been trending up. It's going to be interesting to see how this impacts people's perspectives, because, you know, the thing is that there is a hidden undertone in the polling, in the racism on a lot of this, that a lot of Quebecers don't articulate. But is there.
Oh, but it's not only Quebecers. I'm sorry. I'm going to go there. It's not only Quebecers. Quebecers have the chutzpah to talk about it.
They're the most open.
Right? They are actually the ones that say, okay, we're going to go there. But the rest of the country is tacitly looking at this, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there that are cheering. So let's not be hypocrites ourselves and say this is only a Quebec phenomenon.
No, but I think the Bloc can benefit.
This is also very difficult for the new NDP leader, too.
Right.
Absolutely.
Because this may do a Mulcair on him in Quebec. He needs a base in Quebec of some kind, and he could be losing that very badly. Also, I mean, he may be the next one on the list of those who don't want to see any kind of religious wear at all. I mean, his turban may be next on the list.
Right. Well, that's the question. Is this a revisit for the NDP who, you know, had their orange wave under Jack Layton and they fell under Mulcair? And Jagmeet Singh likes to say high risk, high reward. That's why they elected him. How vulnerable is he on this particular issue, given the fact that religious symbolism for him are very much a part of his identity?
Well, what's interesting about it is that we tend to associate this notion of racism or xenophobia very much with the right wing in the country, but the left wing has a healthy dose of it in and of itself, right? So the question for Jagmeet Singh has to be, what kind of left wing progressive party do you want to helm, and what kind of people do you want in that party? And if you want people in that party who are going to say, I want you to take off your turban or you can't be an elected leader, is that the party you want to run?
If he has a clear message, I think he can nail it, right? He just has to have a very clear message that people can mobilize around, whether they like it or not.
Well, a couple by-elections. We'll find out. I don't know if by-elections, don't read too much into a by-election, folks, but we got a couple next week. That's why Trudeau was in Quebec carefully talking about this, but I got to wrap it up there. Nick Nanos, thanks. Stephanie Levitz, Joyce Napier, Craig Oliver, great to have everybody. Great weekend. And by the way, it's been a very sad week here in Canada. We're going to end today with the bells on the Peace Tower right behind us, playing a tribute to the great Gord Downie, the lead singer of the Tragically Hip, who passed away at the age of 53. We lost one of our best ones, so we'll just go out with that. Hug your loved ones. Thanks for watching. We'll see you back here in 7 days.